Well, as we were thinking a bit earlier, there comes a point in any building construction project when it's time for inspection. It's buildings regulation people time. It's architect visit time. Checking over the whole completed structure to make sure it's up to scratch, because when the owner arrives, having the building been finished, you want him to approve of what's been made. That's where we've got to in Exodus, the very end of the book. Over the past four chapters, the people have been building the tent, this very ornate, very expensive, very particularly planned tent. Because of this incredible expectation they had that somehow when they were finished, God was going to come and dwell in the tent. How would that work? It's difficult to imagine for us God living in a tent. I imagine as they were building it, they would have struggled as well to think what it would look like. But this is the moment of truth. This is the end of the project. Everything finished. And really, there are just two things that happen in these two chapters at the end of Exodus. Firstly, when the people finish, Moses does the building's inspection and gives us his verdict. And then secondly, the owner of the building turns up. God arrives. I think we can take the chapters under three headings. The first two looking back over what we've seen in the book of Exodus, and two of the really big themes. And the third looking forward to where God's story goes next. So firstly, first big theme from Exodus, from this particular section. God's people and their works are genuinely significant. God's people are genuinely significant. We made the point a few chapters ago, which was actually a few months ago, that really God didn't have to get the Israelites to make this tent. After all, this is the God who, back in Genesis 1, made the whole world without their help. He could, presumably, have airdropped in a ready-made tabernacle. But he didn't. He chose to give instructions and to involve the people in the building. He chose to give them the privilege and the responsibility of participating in what he was doing. But how is that going to turn out? It's one thing to involve your child in baking a cake with you, but you know that when you do that, it increases the probability that the result's going to be rather uneven, or is going to end up with a mountain of hundreds of thousands on the top as they empty the entire jar out. How are God's people going to get on with what he'd given them to do? It's hardly like we could miss it from these chapters, is it? It's repeated so much. You can hardly read the verses without coming across, as the Lord had commanded, every other line. That's the overwhelming verdict. It was done just right. They'd done exactly as the instructions had said. They'd done exactly as the owner wanted. That's all the way through the first 31 verses in chapter 39, as they finish off the priestly clothing. It's there in Moses' summary when they bring the finished work to him. That's verses 32 to 43. So verse 33, they brought the tabernacle to Moses, and it lists out everything again. The detail's important, every last bit. Nothing was missing. And the survey report, the summary, verse 42, this is the key grading. The Israelites had done all the work just as the Lord commanded Moses. Moses inspected the work and saw that they had done it just as the Lord commanded. So the grade is A star, full marks, flying colours, no majors, no minors. And that just carries on into chapter 40. As Moses puts together the pieces, the Israelites have made all the bits, and then Moses has the job of bringing them together and actually putting the tent up. And once again we read, as the Lord commanded him. So these chapters couldn't go to more length to emphasize to us the verdict on their work. And let's not underestimate that. Let's not downplay the size of the job, the kind of intricate detail, the effort that was involved. The Bible's not going to let us ignore it. That's why it takes 70 verses explaining it all in detail. We're not allowed to skip over it. I found it interesting just to consider all the different verbs that the passages use for what the Israelites had done. So even just in these two chapters, they made, they hammered, they cut, they mounted, they engraved, they attached, they connected, they fastened, they fashioned, they tied, they embroidered. They tell us that they did the work of a skilled craftsman. They did the work of a weaver. They did the work of an embroiderer. And then there's all the detail that stresses the quality of the work as well. So they made things fine. Things were finely twisted, finely weaved, hammered out thin, pure, skilled. And they made things that worked as well. So verse 21, the breast piece was correctly connected to the waistband so that it couldn't swing out. Verse 23, there was an opening in the center of the robe, and they made a band around it so that it wouldn't tear. And the emphasis, again, is quality. This is good work. This is an Apple Mac, not a Tesco value knockoff. And they did it. They made. It keeps saying, they made, they made. Verse 32, the Israelites did everything. Verse 42, the Israelites had done all the work. Moses saw that they had done it. And that's something. All this good quality work for the Lord means something. It's got significance, and God was pleased by it. How do we know that? After all, the passage doesn't actually say the words, God was pleased with their works. But I think there are three ways we can tell that he was. And firstly is the bare fact that it's all here in the Bible. It's God's Bible, it's his book, he chose what goes in it, and he chose to include all of this, all these verses, about the quality of their work. Secondly, Moses, when he's inspected the work, he blesses them. Verse 43. So Moses is God's representative to them. He's God's appointed leader. And he blesses them. He blesses their work. And then finally, of course, at the end, God shows up. God actually deigns to dwell in the tent that they've built. God chose to involve his people in his plan for history, and they did a good job, and he's pleased. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that they were perfect. You could hardly read the book of Exodus and get away with thinking that. You could hardly read this chapter, because after all, chapter 39, they're making clothes for the priest, mostly. And the person who's going to wear these clothes is Aaron. Mr. I made a golden calf not five chapters ago and led the whole people astray. He's the one who's going to be working at the very center of this tent, and he's one of the biggest mess-ups of all of them. So clearly God's not doing this. He's not counting the people as significant because they deserve it. He doesn't involve them in his plan because they're so great to have on board. It's quite the opposite. Which is why there are these instructions for washing. That's what we see in verse 40. Chapter 40, verse 12, when Moses is setting up the tent, part of his job is to bring Aaron, Mr. Golden Calf, mess up, and wash him with water. Verse 31, actually, every time they come to the tent of meeting, they've got to wash. Reminding them that actually they're not pure. They're not here, they're not involved, they're not privileged like this because of their natural goodness, purity, or achievements. God doesn't involves them in his plan because they're so brilliant. He doesn't care for them and make much of them because they're worthy. He does it in spite of their unworthiness. Even though they're impure, imperfect, and have messed up, God chooses to wash them and make them fit to be part of his plan. And having freely chosen to do that, having put them in that position by his grace, he then delights when they work hard for his glory. And I think there's something significant there for us. The same is true for us. None of us deserves to be part of God's plans at all, which is not the message of our age. It's not the message of the therapeutic age, the age of self-esteem, the age of feeling good about yourself. Our age says, if there's a God out there, then of course he'll be interested in me. Of course he should make much of me, because I'm pretty great, and so are you. That's what people are hearing on graduation day, universities up and down the country. You're amazing. You're amazing. Go out and be amazing. But it's all just words, isn't it? As soon as those young people interact with the real world, we're going to find 100 things we can't do. We're going to find most of our life circumstances we can't control. We're going to find we constantly mess stuff up, and we mess other people up, and they mess us up. And really, in real life, there's no way that you could recommend God puts humans at the center of his plan for history. Which is why it's all the more wonderful that he does. And that's one of the big themes of Exodus, of this book we've been looking at for the past year. God working out his plans for history means God saving his people. And not just saving them from evil, but rescuing them for relationship with him. It's such a big deal. It's both humbling and uplifting. It takes away false, inflated views of ourselves and our own importance. But then it lifts us up with real security. For those who trust in Jesus and become a part of God's people, we get to be a part of God's work. We get to be at the center of God's plan for history, not because we deserve it, but because God has delighted to do it. And furthermore, I think for us as Christians, I think this passage would have us recognize that God takes delight in our efforts as we serve him, imperfect as they are. Sometimes it's been said amongst Christians that even our good works are so small and inconsequential, they're nothing but filthy rags in God's eyes, because they're always going to be tainted by impure motives, because we'll never have a perfectly whole heart. But I don't think that's right. Of course it's true that we're not perfect, and we're very tempted to pride even when we do the right thing for God, and we're always failing in lots of ways, but it doesn't mean that God's never pleased with our obedience. I'm just not sure that's what we read in the Bible. It seems that God is pleased with the good works of his people. And we've got to think about what image of God we have. Is there a problem in our image of God? God isn't watching, waiting eagerly for us to slip up so that he can tell us off. God doesn't choose to represent himself in the Bible as a policeman, but as Father. In this book by Kevin DeYoung, which some of us men in the church are reading, and I think is really helpful, he puts it like this. Why do we imagine God to be so unmoved by our heartfelt attempts at obedience? He is, after all, our Heavenly Father. What sort of father looks at his daughter's homemade birthday card and complains that the colour scheme is all wrong? What kind of mother says to her son, after he gladly cleaned the garage but put the paint cans on the wrong shelf, "This is worthless in my sight"? What sort of parent rolls his eyes when his child falls off the bike on the first try? There's no righteousness that makes us right with God except for the righteousness of Christ. But for those who have been made right with God by grace alone, through faith alone, and have been adopted into God's family, many of our righteous deeds are not only not filthy in God's eyes, they are exceedingly sweet, precious, and pleasing to Him. If you're a Christian, your Heavenly Father is pleased when you obey. He's a father. He cares. He works and disciplines to grow us in holiness, and He's delighted when we grow. It used to be said when I was a student, and it's slightly imprecise, but it helped me. God doesn't hate you for failing in the battle against sin. He loves you for trying. And He's at work in you. Now, of course, it's not an excuse for sin for us if we're not obeying God in our lives at the moment in a particular area. Then God isn't pleased. The Spirit is grieved, says the New Testament. And we need to stop it. But when, by God's help, we do obey, God delights in that. And that's the view of God that we need to put forward to those who aren't Christians and who are around us in our lives. Not God as policeman, not God as spoilsport, not God as tyrant, but God as Father. There really isn't any reason God should treat us as significant, but He does. A message of Exodus, the message of Jesus, is an offer to be washed clean of the things we really have been done wrong, and to be swept up into the heart of God's plan for history. The second thing I think we see from here and from Exodus is that God's glory is awesomely central. God's glory is awesomely central. After all, the building is finished. After all, the inspection is finished. After Moses has put together the pieces and done all the preparation work, well, then the owner turns up. Chapter 40, verse 34. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And we're to make no mistake. Just because there's been a lot of focus on what the Israelites have been doing, we're not to think, therefore, that they've become the center of the story. God is the center. It's all finally about Him and what He does. So Moses finishes the building. He puts in the last piece, and then he stops. And he waits. And the passage doesn't imply that he waited very long. But nonetheless, he couldn't do the next part. He could do verse 33, but he couldn't do verse 34. When the glory of the Lord filled the temple. It's worth stopping, I think, for a moment to consider what that means, because glory is one of those words that can become like jargon for us. It's the kind of word that I find it helpful every so often to pick up and inspect in the light and consider what it really means. People used to sing Glory, Glory, Man United. They're not singing it at the moment, but they used to, because glory is what you get when you win. It can mean fame, honour, recognition. It's the state of affairs when you've achieved something valuable or desirable and everyone knows it. It's when you've become the fastest man in the world and 100 million people watched it on TV. Usain Bolt had glory the other year. God's glory is all that and more. God's glory is when people see what He's done. More than that, God's glory is when people see who He is. It's when people see and recognize the goodness and the beauty and the wonder of who God is. And in the Bible, when that happens, when people see God for who He is, when God reveals Himself to people, there are physical signs that it's happening, because it's so significant and so different from everything else. Here we read about a cloud that covers the tent. A cloud which in verse 38 has fire in it at night time. It's because it's so significant. The cloud and the fire are like big signposts saying what's going on here is like nothing else. It's not random, weird, religious stuff which people reading this for the first time might think. It's got a purpose. It's doing a job. It tells us something. It tells everyone watching. It tells all the Israelites, God is here. And knowing God is like nothing else. God is here. God is with you, just like he promised. Verse 38 tells us, this was in the sight of all the people during their travels, wherever they went. This was there, the cloud and the fire, to tell the Israelites, God is with you, and God is glorious. God is awesome. God is the center of reality. Do you notice when it happens, when God turns up, Moses can't go into the tent, verse 35. Well, what's that about? They spent all this time building the tent so that God could dwell with the people, so they could meet him. And as soon as he turns up, they can't get in. It's a reminder, isn't it, of who's in charge. Same goes for the way that they travelled. So verse 36, we read that as they go through the desert, when the cloud lifts, they set off. But if the cloud's still there, they have to stay put. Just because they've got this tent and they've got God's promise that he's going to be with them, doesn't put God in their pocket. God is still the one calling the shots. It's his plan, his people, for his glory. Again, what a big theme in the book of Exodus. The glory of God. Rupert has a big, thick commentary on Exodus, about that big, that many of us have used over the past year, which has been really helpful. And it has the title, the guy who wrote it gave it the title, Saved for God's Glory. That's his summary of Exodus, which I think is excellent. Saved for God's glory. It holds together these two really big themes in Exodus. Exodus is about the saving of God's people. You can't miss that. They start off in Egypt. They're slaves to a cruel dictator. And God rescues them. He destroys Pharaoh and his armies. He rescues them. And back in chapter 3, when God's explaining why he's going to do it, this is what he says. I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering, so I've come down to rescue them. But in chapter 9, when Moses is bringing the plagues on Pharaoh, God gives another reason for why he's doing this. So that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. And of course, both are completely true. Exodus is the story of the salvation of God's people for God's glory. God's people saved from slavery, brought into a relationship with God, given God's good laws, and with God now actually dwelling in their midst. All for his glory. God's people are genuinely significant, and God's glory is awesomely central. And we can rejoice in both. We can rejoice that God chooses to treat us as significant. And we can rejoice that God is big enough to be at the center of the universe rather than us. Well, final point before we close. Looking forward, God's plan is even bigger and better than this. In a sense, this ending is a cliffhanger. Though it might not look like it. It's really positive. It's a really happy ending. A really, really happy ending. It's a good place to finish the book. But of course, the story's not over. The people are still in the desert. They've been promised a lot of things that they haven't got yet. Like a land to which they've got a journey. And they have this covenant with God, which they've promised to keep. Promise they've already broken once. And the question is open as to how it's all going to turn out. I think there's another little pointer to the future, though, which is kind of subtly there in the details of the building project they've just finished. I'm going to read chapter 39, verse 43 again, and I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. And it might sound familiar. Moses saw everything the Israelites had made, And behold, it was very good, and Moses blessed them. And when you say it like that, it sounds a bit like the accounts of creation from Genesis 1 and 2. God saw what he had made, and behold, it was very good, and God blessed the seventh day. Once you've got that connection back to creation, suddenly you can start to notice all kinds of other connections. Like that strangely tree-shaped lampstand that was supposed to stand in the centre of the tent, rather like the tree of life in the centre of the garden. Like that cherubim stitched into the curtain in front of the most holy place, guarding the way to God's pleasant presence, just as God placed a cherubim at the entrance to the garden to guard the way. Even down to the divisions of the instructions about the building into seven distinct words from God, the last one being about keeping the Sabbath. Even down to the door of the tent being placed on the east side, just like the entrance to the Garden of Eden. And it builds up the case, I think, that in the tent that the Israelites have built, they've built a kind of mini Garden of Eden. They've built a scale model. Well, apart from that being kind of vaguely interesting, why should we care? Because Eden was the place where God dwelt. But the command to Adam in the Garden of Eden wasn't just to stay in the garden, but to multiply and to fill the whole earth and to rule it under the loving rule and in the presence of God. Now that plan looked like it was all over when Adam and Eve rejected the rule of God and were cast out of the garden, but maybe not. For Moses and for the Israelites, if they were paying attention to what they were doing, here's a little hint to them. Maybe not. After all, God has in Exodus gathered together a people, and he's made them build a little mini Eden. And now God's come. His presence is with human beings once more in this little tent. Could it be that God's plan to fill the whole earth with his own people, ruling the world under him and in his presence, isn't over? As amazing as the tent is, it's not the goal of the plan. The end of the plan is far bigger and better than even this. And of course, for us, with the rest of the Bible and the rest of the unfolding of the plan, we can see that. Which is important to grasp as we're trying to make sense of these chapters. These chapters of Exodus can seem hard to relate to. It's a very old book about things that happened a very long time ago. And the tent, so amazing in description, doesn't even exist anymore. But of course, the reason that we think it's worth reading about is because it's part of a plan that's still going on. It's part of a plan, God's working in history, which is still going on, to bring about the day when the whole earth will be filled with his glory. That's our hope. Not that human beings leave behind our petty squabbles and usher in world peace. Not the conquering of disease and poverty and all the other things which genuinely do trouble us and bring us pain. No, our hope, our Christian hope, is that God himself will put the world to rights. God will one day bring down the curtain on this act in history, will remake this world, and a restored and perfected humanity will rule God's new world. And God's presence will be there, unrestricted and unhidden. Of course, to the world, that's quite a prediction to make about the future. But our evidence isn't just a long disintegrated tent from the Middle East. Our evidence is the person of Jesus. Here's what John wrote in his gospel, which Dom pointed us back to last week as well. John's verdict on the Jesus he knew: the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father. Jesus is the continuation of the plan for God to dwell with his people, for God to reclaim and remake his world. This verse points us directly back to Exodus. Jesus was glory come from the Father. And Jesus made his dwelling amongst us, literally made his tent, tabernacled amongst us. And then when Jesus died on the cross, he marked not the failure of God's plan, but the completion of it. Remarkably, Jesus called his death his Exodus. Exodus, saved for God's glory, remember, was our title for it. Because when Jesus died, he took the punishment for the sin of all God's people. He saved his people for the glory of God. He made possible the goal of his plan, the goal of the tent. This tent that the Israelites were building was there to protect them from God's presence. Because if in their sinfulness they were in his holy and pure presence without protection, they'd be destroyed. But Jesus' death to cleanse his people made it possible for the tent to be blasted open. The system of protection is no longer needed. Those people who come to Jesus and have their sin taken away by him can live boldly and without fear with the Holy God. No wonder the curtain between the most holy place and the outside world was torn in two when he died. All of which means there's only one date of significance left in history. One day to come that really matters. One event marked in God's diary. The day when God makes everything new. Everything that was needed to be done to make us ready is done. And now we're waiting for that day. So we've got to the end of Exodus. And it's worth us taking time to think what we'll take away, whether you've been here throughout the whole of the series or come in now right at the end. It's no bad thing, I guess, for us to reread the book and think over some of the things we've learnt and been struck by and can share with one another. I found these three themes have emerged from this last section. I found them helpful to think back over all of the book, the real significance for God's people and what we do, his interest in us, his care for his people, the centrality of God, the fact that he rescues for his glory. It's all really about him. And these pointers forwards to Jesus and to the glorious and better and more wonderful end of God's plan that we're still looking forward to.